Welcome to Public Health Matters with Dr. Christina M. Madison, the founder and CEO of the Public Health Pharmacist, PLLC, a public health consulting firm. She is passionate about spreading knowledge on public health in order to create healthier and happier communities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Public Health Matters with your host, myself, Dr. Christina Madison, also known as the Public Health Pharmacist. So today we have another incredible guest, Dr. Danny Stevens. I'm so thrilled to have him join us all the way from New York City. So with that being said, I just really am excited to have the perspective of another healthcare professional. Dr. Stevens is a pediatrician, has also been in charge of a public health department, has had, you know, so many different roles, lived experiences, is a fantastic man of color. I can't say more wonderful things about him, but I will let him introduce himself, and we're going to dive into some questions, especially on the eve of the new information regarding pediatric COVID-19 vaccines. So with that, Dr. Stevens, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Dr. Madison. I'm very glad that this is just audio, because if I could blush, I am. Thank you for that very kind and generous introduction. It's great to share space with you. It's great to have a conversation. I'm very excited. I think information is increasingly important, and I'm really glad to be a part of a discussion that actually delivers the right information and accurate information. As you mentioned, my name is Dr. Danny Stevens. I come originally from Oakland, California, have been in New York about 16 years, originally moved here for med school and training. So I am a pediatrician by background, have worked clinically at Columbia University, Harlem Hospital, Federally Qualified Health Center in the Bronx, in which I was the director of adolescent medicine. And most recently served as the deputy commissioner for family and child health at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. It's a bold and wonderful division of about 2,500 people with work spanning school health, early intervention, maternal, infant, and reproductive health, as well as the health and well-being of children and youth and families throughout New York City. I was very proud to be in that role, and was in that role for 2 years during the COVID pandemic. And most recently, am the National Director for Family and Child Wellness at the Wellness and Equity Alliance, which is how we met. So that is longer than I probably should be, but I'm happy to dive in and let's talk.
Yeah, well, you have such a breadth and knowledge that, like, I remember when we first met in person, and I was like, I need to know this man, because you have such amazing energy. And like, I can only imagine what you bring to patient care. As a pediatrician, I know that it's challenging sometimes with kids, right? So, you know, from cradle to, you know, late adolescence, you know, it's that population is sometimes hard to please. So you have a great temperament for it. With that being said, let's dive into some of the topics that we chatted about offline. You know, one of the first things I just wanted to chat with you about is around your work with equity and just how you see sort of the landscape of that changing. Especially with all of the health disparities that have been brought more to light during the pandemic and how you see the collaboration between interdisciplinary care models helping to bridge the gap for equity within patient care.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate that as a starting point because, you know, you are a wonderful doctor of pharmacy. I'm a pediatrician. I have surgeon friends. I would not be in my position were it not for my nursing colleagues. And when I think about what led me to this work, equity isn't like the newest trend that folks are talking about. It's actually why a lot of us show up. It's what motivated a lot of us to kind of put up with the training and the grueling hours and everything. And so it's a great place to start because I think that staggering inequity that we know when we look at data, when we take care of patients, when we talk to families, when we live in our communities, those of us with lived experience, even accessing care ourselves, we see it all the time and everywhere. I think that in this moment, it's important to start with that, kind of speaking truth to power and acknowledging that oftentimes health equity makes its way as a slide into a deck. And before recently, we were lucky for that, right? Like, I think when I think about my training in medical school, it's like, you know, this is science. You know, race doesn't have anything to do with this, but actually the science of epidemiology is taking a look at phenomena we're seeing and trying to understand the root causes that are producing what we're seeing, and then leading us to try to intervene. Honestly, I could be discouraged by a lot of what we're seeing. I think COVID unearthed a lot of structural inequity and racism, sexism, homophobia, and just discrimination, xenophobia, that was always there, that has been institutionalized, the likes of which we don't even think. And if you just read headlines, you might think that it's just getting worse. But I am hopeful that with the attention that COVID has shined on inequity and a lot of the work of my fearless colleagues, a lot of the work of our fearless ancestors who have been struggling in this work to highlight this work and do this work before it was acknowledged as work, right? It's so important for me to think about equity work now. And the way we define it as work is interesting because it was subversive. A lot of folks trying to do this work were seen as agitating and doing things to harm the system when in fact they were trying to right and course correct the system. So that's my global take on health equity. More specifically, I think we have a ton of work to do you mentioned Black moms throughout the nation have a 4 times likelihood of dying in childbirth than their white counterparts in New York City, in parts of New York City, that is 8 times as likely if you look at the data in Brooklyn. I think we have a lot of work to do around infant mortality. What I love about public health and we look at root causes. So a lot of stuff that we talk about when I talk about health equity, people might think we're not talking about health, but can we talk about child hunger and food insecurity?
I'm snapping over here.
Yeah, I mean,
like, yes.
One of the things that I often talk about, folks say, well, you worked in government. How was that? Does that align with your background? And one of the things I can say is I'm super proud of some of the things that government did stepping up in response to this global pandemic. In New York City, the Department of Education opened up food distribution sites at schools, the likes of which fed millions upon millions, tens of millions of folks. 2 meals, no questions asked, just showing up at schools and actually feeding folks. I think that is the best work we can be doing, meeting people, meeting basic needs. However, as I told you, I'm from Oakland, California. And if you look back over 50 years ago, that's what the Black Panther Party was founded over. school lunches. Now they've been demonized, right? That's been characterized. But isn't it interesting that we're still trying to solve for that thing? We got to polio, right? Like, we got indoor plumbing. And I'm not saying we don't have issues with that, but nobody builds plans for buildings without indoor plumbing. So how are we at a place now where hungry kids is still a thing?
Well, the indoor plumbing thing is still an issue on tribal lands. Like, there are places in this country where they're still not running water.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for our Indigenous brothers and sisters. So, like, that's still a thing, too.
I know. I just need us to all align that we need to do better. What I am excited about is discontent that I see out of my millennial and zillennial, dare I say, I'm not sure what the term is.
They're Zoomers.
Are they Zoomers? Okay, yeah. Love Gen Z. They are out, they are themselves, they are queer, they are of color, let it out, all the identities. But I'm excited by the discontent I see. I'm excited by the conversations I see. I'm excited by the questions I'm seeing, because we've got to do better. Short answer.
I am here for all of it. Here for all of it. Yeah, no, it's so interesting that you, brought up all of those different things, because I think, when we forget to look back at our history, we are doomed to make the same mistakes. So the fact that you brought up, the foundations of the Black Panther Party and, things around getting basic needs being met. I think about, last month, period poverty awareness and, just things that we don't like, we take for granted as a first world country, you have problems finding sanitary supplies for menstruating persons. Like, yes, like if you have to choose between feeding your children and getting sanitary supplies, which one are you going to pick?
Right.
And like, when you get to that point where when people's basic needs are not being met, everything else goes by the wayside. And in particular, health and preventative health. Right. So if you don't know where you're going to lay your head at night, if you're couch surfing, if you're, rent is not secured. I know that's an issue in New York City, and rents are going up everywhere, and we're having issues with it here. If you don't know where your next meal is going to come from, do you think you're going to be concerned about taking your medications?
Right. Absolutely. And I, there's a colleague, there's a principal I work with in the Bronx a few years ago. And what I loved was he said, my job in terms of education and test scores, I know I come in fifth. I said, what do you mean by fifth? He goes, if kids aren't safe, if they're not housed, if they're not fed, if they're not healthy, how can I expect them to show up ready to learn? So much has to be going right for a child to show up at 8:30, ready to go, ready to learn. And I just love that intersectional way of framing what health and well-being is, because poverty is complex and intersectional. Right. Some of the racism is complex and intersectional. Some of the systems that folks are facing are hundreds of years in design, well-oiled, refined. We talk about QI methodology, right?
Like in the system. No, the system is working exactly the way it was designed.
Right.
And oppress, right?
Like, yes.
It's doing exactly what it was designed to do.
That's right. But I'm glad that you mentioned the preventative piece, because, COVID was humbling to all of us, right? Like I was at the largest health department in the country with some of the world's leading experts, and we were doing everything we could to understand COVID. But I remember being in the room when that first paper came out. It was from China, and I think the study sample was six kids, but it's all we had in terms of a pediatric population. We obviously know more now, and we have more to learn. But I remember grasping for whatever we could understand, and we felt like we were behind. And I think that more focus on primary care, more focus on public health, more focus on prevention, more collaboration with our professional colleagues. We could talk about this more, but I love pharmacists. I love nurses. I love health tech. I love community health workers, because it takes all of us. And what we're trying to solve for is enormous and complex, almost don't do it justice. I'm kind of like, as the kids say, gagging, trying to come up with the right words for what we're up against and the stakes. And so I'd love to talk to you about that intersection and the opportunities there, about how we work together, how we've been called and forced to work together, mm-hmm. and what we can learn from what has happened. Because as humbling as COVID was, we should be doing better next time.
Well, are we prepared for the next pandemic? I think that's the thing that, those are the things that keep me up at night, right? It's like, yes, we figured out how to manage this, you know, relatively well. Mm-hmm. But are we prepared for the next thing, right? So like, I, you know, just saw this thing about monkeypox, and I'm like, oh my God, like, it's like the next communicable illness that's like potentially going to challenge the system again, because we're not prepared, because we're not resilient, we're not nimble, we're not flexible, we're very rigid. We can't turn on a dime when necessary, right? And I think that's what the work that you and I have been doing with WIA, you know, like, it's that needing to be nimble, needing to be flexible, and to meet the needs of the moment, which I think absolutely needs to be interdisciplinary. You know, it's not going to just be physician led. It's not going to just be pharmacist led. It's not just going to be nurse led. It's not going to just be, you know, community health workers, which are, you know, the connective tissue that like helps us run everything, right? And get those underserved and vulnerable populations to the table. It's all of us working together in order to make healthier, happier communities. And that's the goal, right? Like, I was on a call the other day and they asked me like, you know, how are things been going? Like, what have you been doing in the last 2 weeks? And I was like, I'm living in my joy. Like, I want that for everyone, right? Like, it's taken me so long to get to this point in my life, in my 42 years, to just be able to sit back and live in my joy. I'm like, how did this happen? You know, that it took me this long, you know, but I want that for everyone. And that's not the case, because right. health and equity causes so much stress, right? It's not just the acute stress in the moment for the illness. It's the chronic stress from discrimination, from stigmatization, from racism, from neglect, right? That is a combination that ages you, that your physiologic age is very different from your chronologic age.
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Madison, ooh, you just said a word. I can't agree more. It's more than just like a respect for my colleagues in pharmacy and nursing and community health work, right? I think of it of one of the things I did before I went to medical school was I was a fourth grade teacher. I was an AmeriCorps alumni. Aww. I taught fourth grade in Compton, California, in Compton Unified. And I don't know if this is helpful or not, but one of the things I noticed is when we would have parent-teacher night, I so desperately wanted to reach my whole classroom of kids. I wanted everyone to show up. I wanted to engage with everyone. I wanted to share the good, the bad, the ugly, the successes. And what I found was that phenomenon that the families that came to parent-teacher night, by very nature of showing up, we almost self-selected for the families who were already doing most of the supportive things they could for families, right? And so it was like, how can I get to the families that can't come? The parents that are working two jobs, the parents that cannot actually or don't have the background or perspective to come. And that to me is the nature of meeting people where they are. That's where that term comes from and comes back to for me. So when I apply that lens to health and well-being, right, I think of how do we do better? How do we show up for people when they need us? You were talking about that John Henryism, right? That weathering that is, what can chronic stress do to one's overall life? I was talking to my husband this week about, oftentimes folks talk about the Tuskegee experiments, right? Which I'm gonna call the US government experience at, experiments at Tuskegee. And the last one was conducted in 1973, which is the year my brother was born. So history to some, but for a lot of us, not that far.
No, it's not that far away. I mean, you're saying that that was the year your brother was born. And then I think about my mom, who's in her 60s, who went to a segregated elementary school.
That's right. And just this week, it came out that, although the experience were kind of documented and at this point, probably should be even more so. Just this week, the New York Times, or this past week, published about how certain philanthropies in New York paid for funeral expenses, obligating families to then consent for autopsy. And so the more we find out about how we have been showing up, it helps us really understand. People talk about not just vaccine hesitancy, but system health literacy. And my colleague in New York, Dr. Torian Easterling, puts it the best, where he's like, people talk about and ask about whether people trust the government. And he's like, that's the wrong question. It's about how do we as government show up and be trustworthy? That's exactly where we need to focus. That's how we need to spend our energy. That's what we need to talk about, because it's much more than a PowerPoint deck, right? And that to me is how we can best put our heads together. I got my booster in CVS Pharmacy on 10th Avenue. I'm going to shout out to my Midtown folks in New York, right? My first vaccine was in a city run COVID site. I was working there and got my first shot there, but look at where I was by the time I got my booster. And I think that that's an evolution of, and an example of how we need to begin to think and frame showing up and what that means to show up. Another one of my, one of my former lives, I worked as a vice president in a nonprofit in New York that served and focused on foster youth, or youth in foster care. And one of the conversations we had was about, what's our late policy in clinic, right? When somebody shows up late, what do we do? How many minutes? How do we fit them into the schedule? And when I tell you what some of our families had to go through to show up, right? One kid would have an appointment, five kids would roll in. Because if you don't have childcare, guess what? Everybody's coming, and everybody has to be fed. Everybody has to be dressed, and everybody has to get on a train and maybe another train. And sometimes if foster youth are living in the Bronx, but the birth family is in Staten Island, that might be an hour and a half commute within New York City.
Wow.
So that's how we then enter a discussion about what's our late policy. Right. And we're not a for-profit pediatric factory. So how do we work folks into the system that is so harmful?
And stop getting them.
Yeah. So anyway, that is long distance from saying I love that pharmacists are vaccinating. I know you didn't ask for it. I know it came to us, but I am so excited about, what does that mean? How can we partner further? What's next? What health information can pharmacists engage in? They are trusted messengers in some polypharmacy. A lot of folks in pediatrics, thankfully, most kids are healthy. So I didn't experience a lot of kids with a lot of different prescriptions, but I look at myself, I look at my parents. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we go to appointments and say, yeah, we're taking it all. But the people getting and fielding those questions are pharmacists.
Oh yeah,
I love it. I, our pharmacists of color, our pharmacists that serve queer BIPOC folks, our pharmacists that serve folks who are experiencing homelessness, our pharmacists who experience, who are helping folks who are struggling with substance abuse. I'm here for all of it because we need all of us and then some. We are not meeting the needs.
Stay safe, be well, and remember, public health matters.